why would we move this studio from wherever it is now, Poland, Ukraine, Turkey, whatever, right? To Abu Dhabi, to Dubai, to Riyadh, wherever.
Next level. Next level on the ABXY podcast with Ziad, with Paul, the Prophet Dawalibi. In this episode, we learn more about Paul's experience, how he started, how he got into gaming, how he had governments lay the groundwork for gaming and tech ecosystems, how to grow these gaming and tech ecosystems. What's his take on the MENA region, on the gaming ecosystem specifically, as well as we'll hear some buzzwords in the industry that are super interesting. Paul, I'm really happy to have you here.
Ziad, it's my pleasure. So excited to be on the podcast.
Thanks, Paul. Likewise. So let's start by, can you tell me more about yourself?
I don't know where you want me to start, but you know, my career, I think, has been in and around the venture world in some way or another for most of it. And when I say that, really, I started my career building tech companies as a founder, as an entrepreneur. That, after some success, really evolved into investing in tech companies. So I worked as a VC for many years. I managed a well-known venture capital fund called Garage, which had this mandate to sort of connect Silicon Valley companies and Canadian tech companies. So I was very instrumental in building that Canadian tech ecosystem in its early years. And as the years went on and I had successes in that venture space and that startup world, I actually ended up investing in a company in the entertainment space. And that was interesting for me. It was probably the first entertainment deal that I had done. It was a tech company, but in entertainment. And as a gamer, I was excited to touch something that was close to my personal passion and my personal hobby. But it really got me thinking and looking at the entertainment space more broadly. So while that company was all about shoppable video, it had me looking at what was going on in entertainment in general. And at the time, gaming was just having its sort of come out moment. It was, you know, Ninja was on the Tonight Show. People all of a sudden were talking about gaming. And I decided at that point to pivot everything I was doing, whether it was investing, whether it was media, whether it was consulting, everything I was doing to gaming. I was convinced that I had a thesis that gaming was going to be the biggest industry on the planet. And so all of the activities, all the things that I was really good at, company building, investing, media, content, that kind of thing, I pivoted everything to gaming and have been doing that basically for the last 8 years.
Okay, so I wanted to ask, when was that? So for the last 8 years, and this is, it all happened back in Canada, right?
Canada was where I really started my career. It's where I built my first startups. It's where I had my big first successes. Even more recently, like, I founded a company when I was living in Canada that went on to become the 2020 fastest growing company in Canada. So I had big success in the tech and startup scene in Canada, but I really left Canada in 2015, 2016 and moved to the US. So I was in New York for many years before being in the Middle East.
Cool. And what were these companies about? Like, the companies you founded or the companies that you ran?
It's interesting because technology, if you look at venture and tech over the last 25 years, there's always some hot cycle, right? There's always the next hot thing. Today we talk about AI and gaming and Web3 and metaverse, right? Like, they all come in these cycles, but that's not a new phenomenon. Like, there were these cycles 25 years ago. So in the beginning, it was really social mobile local was the hot first trend that I really capitalized on, where I had this idea to help financial services companies, banks specifically, mobilize their workforce. This is an era before app stores. This is an era before iPhones, right? Where banks...
But how would they mobilize?
Well, they were starting to give employees BlackBerries, which maybe some of your listeners may not even recognize that term, but it was the iPhone before the iPhone. But they had nothing that they could do with these BlackBerries other than email.
Or BBM.
BBM. Yeah. And what we did was we came in and we said, hey, we'll develop applications for you on this platform. So maybe you as a a field service person or a client representative in the field could use your BlackBerry to access a client record. Things that seem trivial today.
Yeah.
But in a world without app stores was actually quite difficult. And we capitalized on that early. And then, you know, the local trend was really hot in venture. So I ended up taking over a company that I had invested in in the local space. And what we were doing there was we were trying to figure out, for example, if a woman posted on Twitter, "I'm so excited, my boyfriend just proposed." Well, we knew in that moment that woman probably needed a florist, a wedding planner, a limo company. And so we were trying to disrupt the Yellow Pages. What we were trying to do was go after the Yellow Pages and connect that woman in her moment of need with the kind of local services that she might buy. You know, I had some success there, despite the fact that even today, Google has not fully disrupted Yellow Pages. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's an entire generation that still think Yellow Pages is relevant. But I think steadily over the decades, my career has been about what is that future trend and how do I capitalize on it?
Yeah. Interesting. And then you got into gaming after this, the investment in the video shopping platform.
Yep.
What was your first experience in the gaming space, in the business of gaming?
Yeah, I think my first experience was actually an interesting one, and it drove a lot of what I focused on in those early days. So first of all, I started from a thesis, which is how I've always done my own investing, how I've managed my own career. I start with a thesis that not only I believe in, but that I think I can convince other people of. And so I had two elements to this thesis around gaming. One was, if you look at humanity over the last 20,000 years, and this is getting awfully cerebral, but if you look at the humanity over the last 20,000 years, the one trend that's consistent, literally the only trend that's consistent, is work is in decline. And what I mean by that is increasingly machines are doing more and more of the work that we as humans used to do for ourselves. And this is machines in all forms. It could be a piece of software. It could be a robot. It could be literally just a machine. But increasingly, machines are doing more of the stuff we used to do for us. And with AI, the hot friend of the day, this is accelerating. And this puzzled me even at the time, you know, even years ago now, because I thought, why are all these people going to conferences? And at the time, the AI people were... The previous term for that were future of work people.
Yeah.
Right? They were future of work investors, but they were really AI investors. Let's call it that. And at the time, I thought, why would you invest in the shrinking piece of the pie? If we believe that AI is going to take over and do all this work for us, yes, it's interesting in the moment. You may make money in the moment, but the long-term growth trend is, what do we replace all that work time with? The growing piece of the pie is leisure. It's fun. It's entertainment. So I built this thesis, which I coined, the future is fun. I literally trademarked this phrase because I believe that's where the future of humanity is going, where fun will drive everything we do with our lives. Because at some point, the machines, the robots do everything for us. You know, it's the WALL-E future where we're fat and lazy and we're sitting in chairs and we're just consumers of whatever. I believe that's where humanity is going, rightly or wrongly, meaning whether you agree with that moral standpoint, this is where the technology is taking us. So that was the first sort of anchor for the thesis. The second anchor for the thesis was the Star Trek nerd in me. And this is why I called my company Holodeck. I don't know if you, do you know what a holodeck is, right?
Yeah, but I mean, the listeners don't know that the company is called Holodeck. So Holodeck is the company that you're currently,
Holodeck is my umbrella business that holds everything I'm doing in gaming.
Okay.
It's the parent company that everything I do in gaming, whether it's investment, consulting, media, whatever, falls under Holodeck.
Okay, cool.
Okay? But Holodeck for me had meaning, and it was the second component of my thesis of why I think gaming becomes the biggest industry on the planet. That's the thesis. Gaming will be the biggest industry on the planet, and it won't even be close. We're talking two orders of magnitude bigger than the next biggest industry. We're talking about tens of trillions, maybe hundreds of trillions. And it's anchored in that future is fun component. But the second part of it is this idea of holodecks. And a holodeck, for the listeners who are not, or the viewers who are not Star Trek geeks, was a room on a starship. Okay? And you could go into this room and you could ask the holodeck for anything you wanted. So you could say, I want to go skiing in the
Blue Genie.
And
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And the holodeck would turn into the Alps. In other words, all of a sudden, instead of being an empty room, you've got snow under your feet, it's cold, you have skis on, you're high up, you feel the wind. To your brain, our primitive, you know, primate brain, the holodeck became the Alps. I believe firmly, am convinced, that human beings are going to develop holodecks. It's coming faster than people think. Star Trek has maybe the best track record of predicting future technology than any other show ever invented. And we can argue maybe Gene Roddenberry was an alien from the future, the creator of Star Trek, or maybe engineers who grew up watching the show like me just wanted to build what they saw. But holodecks are coming. And if you at least agree with that piece, well, the implications of holodecks are deep, very deep. This disrupts humanity in a way we've never seen before. It's a bigger disruptor than the printing press, the wheel, and the railroad all in one. And I'll tell you why. Because even those things didn't disrupt every industry. Holodecks change everything. And I'm talking about travel. Holodecks completely disrupt the travel industry. Why would I get on a plane and then a stinky bus and then be harassed by a ton of beggars to go stand 200 meters away from the pyramids and take a picture when I can go stand in a holodeck and go climb the pyramids? And to my brain, and this is where I think people get hung up, no, I want the real life experience. I want to touch and feel. I'm telling you, the holodeck will replicate reality in every aspect. Your brain will not know the difference. And so travel gets disrupted. Education, because we learn through play. Retail gets disrupted. All of retail is going towards more experiential, right? Well, the holodeck is that on steroids.
But how would this holodeck look like? How would I interact with that?
So I think this is where some people get hung up. Because we look at the state of technology today and we say, oh, it's, you know,
VR
goggles. And I don't want to go around with goggles on my face. Okay, that's the state of the art today. And despite that very crude technology, because I'll argue it's basically just lenses and some, you know, it's a mobile phone and some lenses. Despite that, it's still very good at convincing us that it's real.
Yeah.
I often use, have you ever done the walk the plank?
Yeah.
Right? Like where you get in an elevator.
The scariest thing that you can do.
Yeah. Like your conscious brain knows 2 minutes ago you were standing on solid ground.
Yeah, you get your brain gets tricked.
It gets tricked very easily. And if you look at some of the psychologists like who have done studies on this, like our brain is very easy to fool. Yeah. Remarkably easy. So do I think we will end up with goggles 10, 15, 20 years from now? No. Do I have the answer in terms of what the holodeck looks like in implementation? It may be a room like Star Trek with force fields and floors that move in all directions. And already we've seen, Disney announced something called HoloTiles. They're stealing my holodeck branding. HoloTiles and like all of these technologies are being built. I've seen technologies to mimic scent, mimic taste. But I think the end result is probably something close. If you put a gun to my head and said, what does the implementation of the holodeck look like 20 years from now? I think most likely it's like Neuralink. That's the on-ramp and off-ramp. In other words, you don't need fancy equipment and fancy rooms.
You need to be tricked.
That's it. So if I have direct access to the part of your brain processing these things, I don't need to produce a fake scent. I don't need to produce a fake touch. I can do it all direct. So I think it's more Matrix style where we plug in than maybe anything else.
Interesting. Okay, this is too deep. I did not expect to start this deep, but it gets me to the place where I ask you, this is what got you into gaming? I mean, apart from the video shopping company, you're telling me that you're calling this company Holodeck because it's a thing that inspired you as a young engineer. Where are you today in that vision? I mean, you started Holodeck.
Yeah.
And what have you done since then?
I think, so those, that realization that the future is fun, that holodecks were going to change humanity. They call me the prophet. Most people know me as the prophet, spelled with an F.
Yeah. F-I-T.
F-I-T. Yeah. There's a reason for this, because I'm very pragmatic about the things that I do. In other words, I try not to get hung up on this is bad for humanity or this is good for humanity. Where I focus is, will this happen, regardless of how Paul Dawalibi feels? And if I think it will, how do I make money from it? And I think gaming, as a consequence of holodecks, as a consequence of fun and leisure being the growing piece of the pie, gaming becomes the biggest industry on the planet and therefore will be the biggest wealth creator on the planet. So while I can talk about, hey, I'm really passionate about gaming and I'm a gamer since I'm 2 years old and, you know, I want to see this industry flourish and I want, like, yeah, those are nice, lofty goals. But at the end of the day, I see an opportunity for wealth creation that has never existed in the history of humanity.
I like.
And so it's being driven in a large part by, can I profit from this? Mm. So what I've done is I'm trying to think about a 20-year plan that works backwards from holodecks. And part of that is, how do I create an ecosystem that will be supportive of this kind of breakthrough? And in my mind, this region, the Middle East, whether it's Dubai or Abu Dhabi or Saudi Arabia or any of the, you know, the states in this region that are bullish on gaming, to me, I found a willing participant to help realize this vision. That's how I saw it, right? Because in the West, when you're dealing with business, you're constrained by what you can do in business. The beauty of operating here is you have governments who have conviction, who have religion about gaming, and are willing to invest, hopefully, in the long-term play. Not the, you know, what is the GDP contribution next year? Well, that's important, but it's how do we build a trillion-dollar business in Abu Dhabi, for example, in 10 years? That's the exciting part. So what have I done? I think a large part for me since then was two things. One was evangelism, which I think is important and is not done enough. In other words, how do I tell that story to enough people and get them to see my vision and get them to join my side? Because I can't do this alone. I need 1,000 smart people, 10,000 smart people, 100,000 smart people to realize, oh yeah, this thesis makes sense. I can get on board with that. How can I help build that? How can I contribute? So evangelism was important. And I started this even when I was in the US with a podcast.
Okay, cool.
How do I start talking about the business side of gaming and getting people excited about it? How do I open people's eyes who maybe they thought gaming was just a thing teenagers did in their basement and get them to start thinking about it, investing in it, talking about it? And so the initial opening that I saw was no one is talking about the business side of gaming in an insightful way. It was journalists who know nothing about gaming or know nothing about business, one or the other. And so what insight am I getting from that journalist who's going to tell me what this merger between these two studios means for the future of gaming? They can't. So that was the first opening, the first white space I moved into, which was, okay, I can start controlling the narrative a little bit. I can start inspiring people. I can start getting my vision out to the world. And so content and media was that very first play. That is what a lot of what I've done over the last few years, last many years now, was content. You know, today I host a show on CNBC Arabia.
You know,
it has a very large audience in this region. I'm very proud of that show. I think it really serves the purpose of winning hearts and minds.
Yeah.
So that evangelism and that content and that media piece is a big part of what I've done in that time frame. I think the second thing is really working with the major players, whether that's big gaming companies, small gaming companies, governments, to get people on board on a path that leads me to that holodeck future. And that's not always easy. Because if you try selling people today on holodecks. You will lose. You will get the visionaries, but you will lose the bureaucrat who's maybe working in government. So you have to go step by step, right? And so step one is, okay, how can we build really smart programs, for example, in governments to support gaming companies and gaming technologies? How can we build programs to create dense gaming ecosystems? How can we create the building blocks of what becomes that holodeck future? And so that evangelism morphs into almost government lobbying, where it's working with governments, working with major players to try and get them on this path towards success. And I would say I've done that to some success, because working with government is tricky.
Yeah.
But
I'm getting into this.
But this is where there's still a lot of work to be done. In this region, governments are all, we know the Saudis are spending billions, $38 billion to be exact. Abu Dhabi has spent a lot of money. Dubai has a program for gaming now. RAC is thinking about gaming. The free zones are thinking about, have gaming programs or gaming centers. And so we're getting to this point where at some point you hit this critical mass where there's enough momentum, enough energy, enough people moving in the same direction. But it takes a lot of work and a lot of time to get there.
Yeah, that was my next question. Apart from different questions I wanted to touch on, we will get back to those. But knowing that you've been part of of an investment vehicle in North America, specifically, I think, in Canada and in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
How and now you're part of, or you're close to people who are part of setting ecosystems or trying to create ecosystems.
Yeah.
How would you compare your experience in North America versus your experience here? And where would you say you are positioned in this region as compared to North America in terms of creating ecosystems? I'm not sure if you've been part of gaming or the games business in North America, but if you were, how do we compare in terms of the policies that we have here in the region versus over there, as well as the talent, the investment vehicles, the money, like, you know, across the board?
Yeah, that's a great question. Some of my earliest experience in Canada was building the tech and startup ecosystem that exists there today. I'm very proud of that, that a lot of that exists because of the work I did in the early 2000s to build those ecosystems that exist there. That was not trivial. It required government support. It required private sector support. It required a lot of people moving in the same direction. I coined a term at the time that people have adopted called density of intensity, which is what I believe you need to build a successful ecosystem. You need enough intensity all moving in the same direction at sufficient density for good things to happen. And that Canadian experience is what I've leaned on over the years in terms of thinking about other ecosystems, including here. And, you know, the fund I managed in Canada was a product of the realization that the government could not do all of this on their own. They needed to put capital in the hands of the private sector. And part of that was to spur startups to come there. But you have to create an ecosystem for those startups to thrive. It's not enough just to give them money or give them subsidies. By the way, I invented subsidies for startups in Canada. The SR&ED credits that still exist to this day, right, 25 years later, was something I created and has been copied by governments and ecosystems all over the world.
Well, what is it for those who are watching that don't know?
Well, it's a subsidy where that said, basically, if you were doing anything you could remotely categorize as R&D, which could have been a developer, which could have been anything that was technology, basically, the government, if you paid that person $100,000 a year, the government would return you $50,000 at the end of the year, essentially as a subsidy, to cover the cost of doing what they felt was important work in Canada. And it was a way of being competitive with the U.S. So what you had was a lot of U.S. companies, even, who realized we could put a bunch of developers in Canada, even in the games industry. Why do you think Ubisoft ended up with a huge game studio in Montreal? A lot of it was driven by media credits, SR&ED credits, government support, that allowed for much cheaper development with very highly talented people still and made it very competitive. And so it's not something that happened overnight though, right? Like the startup ecosystem that exists in Silicon Valley took 50 years. to build to what it is today, essentially. The startup ecosystem that exists in Canada, I'll argue, 20, 25 years. The challenge is, this part of the world, everyone wants to do it in three.
Yeah, shortcuts.
And money solves some of those problems, but not all of those problems. And so you need the patience. You need the conviction over a long period of time. You need the commitment over a long period of time. You need the talent. You need the right programs. You need all of these elements. It's really a holistic view that I think is what fascinates me about ecosystem building. There's not one silver bullet. An investment program doesn't create an ecosystem. An academy for talent doesn't create an ecosystem. One successful startup doesn't create an ecosystem. But you start putting all those elements together, and that's what happened in Canada in the early 2000s, right? You had Research in Motion with BlackBerry, was a huge success, all of a sudden puts Canada on the startup map. Governments start implement subsidies and tax credits, puts Canada on the map. They start messaging the US, hey, we're open for business, puts Canada on the map. And all of a sudden, talent starts to flow in. Smart people start to flow in. There's an opportunity to make money. There's an opportunity to build interesting things there. And it happens over time. But you can't leave one of those things out.
Mm.
And that's what has to happen here. And I lean on that experience of building that tech ecosystem in Canada. To me, it's no different. Building the gaming ecosystem here, I use the same model I use there.
But don't you think it could be, it was a bit more organic in Canada? In terms of talent flow? No. Okay.
It was very conscious. Really was. A lot of these were programs I either helped create or was involved in creating.
Mm.
It was very much an active thing. Like, before me, no Canadian VCs blogged.
Yeah.
I started doing this not because I cared about being famous. I started doing this because I wanted to evangelize to the world that Canada was a great place to build a startup. And these were the reasons why. And so, yes, some of it's organic and you need some luck also, right?
Yeah, like definitely.
You get these huge successful startups, not like you can do everything right and still have no successes.
I want to touch on that, on luck.
Yeah, it's important.
Yeah, because we've had a big success in the region. We've had multiple ones, actually, specifically acquisitions. We have the government investing in the ecosystem. We have the right policies, at least on a business level. We have the talent.
Yeah.
What do you think we still lack as compared to, like, let's say the Canadian, your Canadian experience at least? Or is it only time? I'm not sure.
No, there's definitely areas that I think are lacking. And to me, the biggest blind spot today is the evangelism. It's the winning of hearts and minds. Because when you're sitting in Dubai or you're sitting in Abu Dhabi, you're in an echo chamber.
Yeah.
Right? Everything's hyped here. Everything's exciting here. Everyone's trying to do something really cool. Like, the energy level's high, and that's great, right? But if you go to LA and you ask, or Poland, let's pick something even more remote, mm-hmm. right? Like, and you ask the developer there, sitting there, game developer or a developer in general, right? Would you move to Abu Dhabi? I mean, it's maybe the first time they've ever even considered this. Yeah. It's not something they even think about. It's not even on their radar. And to me, that's the biggest blind spot so far, which is Saudi Arabia can spend all the billions of dollars that they want, can buy all the companies they want. If they're not winning the hearts and minds of everyone globally, if they don't have enough global charisma to get people to go, I should move to Riyadh.
Mm.
You won't win on the scale they want to win at. There's an exercise of winning hearts and minds that's a marketing exercise, first and foremost, that I think is not being done nearly to the level it needs to be.
I wanted to ask you if you think what's being done today is on the right track, because I think there have been some interesting initiatives marketing wise, like today the region is hosting more than one F1 Grand Prix. It's hosting some of the biggest tech events in the world. It's attracting talent, and it's also subsidizing talent. I mean, to get talent from abroad. I mean, there are systems in place that are happening today in order to reach that that level. But why do you think, you just told me that you think it's we're not even close to the potential. Yeah. Why is that?
It's a combination of things. You need the right message and you need the right messenger.
Mm.
And while sometimes we may get the message right, very often we get the messenger wrong. And the bigger the ambition, the greater the cult of personality around the messenger needs to be. And I'll use an analogy.
Simple terms.
you want to start a cult, okay? If you are fine with being a cult of five people operating out of your parents' basement, you know, waiting for the aliens to show up to take you to their planet, you don't need the most brilliant, charismatic leader in the history of cults.
Yeah.
You don't. You need to convince five people that this is a good idea. If I told you, though, that you want billions of people to join your cult, and you want hundreds of thousands of people to uproot their lives, to give you money, to whatever, right? To drastically change something. Well, the requirements change dramatically. And so with greater ambition come greater requirements. The hurdles are larger, meaning in some ways the region is a victim of its ambition.
Yeah.
But I don't fault ambition, because I think ambition is good. It's good to have very lofty goals. I love that the Saudis have such lofty goals around being a global gaming hub. Where the wheels fall off a little bit is you go, okay, you want to be a global force in gaming. Okay. What do you need? Well, you need a leader who has deep gaming expertise. Okay. That's easy to find. There's a lot of people who have gaming experience. Okay. But you need a leader who has decades of investment expertise, can deploy capital in the most efficient way, spend it in the best possible way. Well, okay. Gaming knowledge and investment expertise. Well, now that narrows down.
Yeah.
And they need to be able to build a high growth organization with tens of thousands of people, probably. Oof. Okay. That list of people is getting really small now. And they need to be that charismatic cult of personality who's going to sell Saudi gaming to the world, who's going to win hearts and minds, who's going to get people excited about what's going on in Saudi Arabia and gaming, who will literally get up and move to Riyadh just because this guy says it's the future. Oof. Now there's maybe three people on the planet who check all the boxes.
Yeah.
Are any of those people in Saudi Arabia?
No.
No.
Maybe not in the region.
So that's why I think some people feel it has not lived up to the hype yet. Because the ambition is big, and so the requirements on the talent, on the initiatives, on the programs, on all of these things, the bar is so high for all of them.
Yeah, maybe it would have been better to start small, in your opinion.
No, it's just not my style.
Not your style.
I think it's better for them, for the region to have some failures, realize where the missteps were, change some of the people, and try again with the same ambition. Because I think the second time around, they will get it much more right.
Yeah.
And that requires some patience. It requires some humility, right? That's not always easy to say, you know, we messed up. This was maybe the wrong person. This was maybe the wrong initiative. But there's enough smart people who care enough, I think, that these problems will get solved over time. It will be painful, but they will get solved over time.
It's like a normal startup. You have to fail and pivot and fail and pivot to get to the right place.
Such a good analogy.
Yeah. Okay. I like this. I mean, it's super interesting. I have like a question. Maybe I'm not sure if you've been involved with companies or with talent in like North America and Europe. And I'm sure you've been involved with talent here in the region. How do you think we compare as a region in terms of gaming talent, in terms of potential?
let me speak generally first, because I'm actually really passionate about this, which is I find what's lacking in the talent is not skill sets. It's not necessarily passion about the subject matter.
Yeah.
What's lacking sometimes is, or what you see maybe too often in this region, is what I call tourists, career tourists.
Mm.
In other words, something's hot here. Let me go make a bunch of money and then let me leave. And then I don't really care what happens after that. And I think career tourists kill ecosystems. The bedrock of a successful ecosystem needs to be the exact opposite of that. You need
skin in the game, people.
People who care, like at a deep, like the same way you care about a relationship or a marriage, right? Like who are in it for the long haul, right? Come hell or high water, through, you know, sickness and in health, right? Like this kind of devotion to seeing a vision come to life. And you get that devotion partly through leadership, right? It comes top down, but also partly in the way you actually attract people, right? If the only incentive is financial, you'll get a lot of career tourists. If the incentives go beyond that, you're going to be part of something big here. You're going to be building something really that will define this region for the next 100 years. This starts to become a different calculus in people's heads, and you get people who see that vision. Like, people have come to work for me in startups many, many times over the years and taken less money than they were making before they came to work for me. Why?
Experience, learning.
Yes, those are good things, I agree. But also this idea of they're going on an adventure and they're going to be building something really
good. Yeah. Definitely.
That is a feeling that is not instilled often enough here. Too much is driven by come here, get rich. Not come here, build something lasting. And so part of it is, how do you get rid, or at least not get rid, but differentiate between the career tourists and what value they add? Because they do add value, right? I don't want to discount that entire group. They are important in some ways. But then what is the bedrock? What is the foundation? Who are the people who are there because they care? And that I call commitment and continuity. I talk about commitment and continuity all the time. In other words, you need people who are committed to the cause and are willing to see it through, that continuity. I'm not a gaming guy today and tomorrow I'm an AI guy, right? You see a lot of that.
Yeah.
And then the next day I'm a crypto guy and whatever I think I can make a buck on.
Yeah. You need to inspire people.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. And I had just a question that came to my mind. Since you're on the VC side, and since you've worked outside of the region, what advice would you give a studio that is looking to come to the region? Since they're hearing like lots of interesting news about the region, how would you approach settling into the region in order to maybe like becoming like being part of this? How would you position yourself? How would you approach this?
Yeah, I think you always, when you're making a business decision like that, it has to be driven by a business decision. In other words, why would we move this studio from wherever it is now, Poland, Ukraine, Turkey, whatever, right? To Abu Dhabi, to Dubai, to Riyadh, wherever. And I think today, a lot of that is driven by financial incentives. Right? No question. Because there's so much investment coming out of, for example, Saudi Arabia. A lot of that decision is, okay, if I move to my studio to Riyadh, someone's going to give me a check for millions of dollars. And I don't think that's a bad thing at all. Now, do I think that's the case for everyone? It's not that simple, right? Like there's not just bags of money waiting for game studios at the airport.
Yeah.
But I do think the opportunity is there. And being in the middle of a wave is usually a good place for a startup, meaning you're better off being in a place that's hot if you want to have success than a place that's dead.
Yeah.
So there's no question opportunities to raise capital that maybe don't exist in in other places. Now, the West has a more fleshed out VC ecosystem, no question. There's more VCs that invest in gaming. There's more VCs that have knowledge about gaming investment, right? You find more deep expertise. But I think there's much less money flowing overall.
Yeah, but I liked something that you mentioned in the beginning, that the government in Canada actually collaborated with the private sector in order to create an ecosystem. I feel that money in the region here is mostly driven by the public sector.
Keep in mind, when Canada privatized their venture industry, though, all of those funds that were created, because they created half a dozen venture funds, of which mine was one of, was the first, basically.
What was it called?
Garage.
Ah, okay, the Garage one, okay.
It was Garage Canada, and the idea was we were going to take Canadian startups and plug them into the Valley, because Garage was a very famous venture fund in the Valley. Guy Kawasaki, the art of the start, he was the chief evangelist for the Mac under Steve Jobs. You see, there's a thread of evangelism. I think my destiny was to be a cult leader of some kind. but the interesting part is that the funds were backed by government dollars. And a lot of the times, maybe this was one of the mistakes Canada made, was the same bureaucrat who was investing when they were in government just created their own fund and the government handed that same person the money to manage, right? So it's not like the talent really changed. It was just the structure that changed. Now, that was important, though, because it allowed for foreign capital to flow into those funds over time. But it still required an initial push from the government.
And the leap. Yeah.
And Canada is a resource-rich country, right? Has oil, has a lot of natural resources. And so it can do those things. The UAE is in a very similar position. Saudi Arabia is in a very similar position, right? There's no reason governments shouldn't be priming the pump. And I'm not saying you have to invest $1 billion a year forever. No, you need to put $1 billion in the right hands initially, prime the pump, and then let the private sector take over. But it's that initial push that I think is required, especially when your value as a country in some of these places is you're resource rich, right? Like you asked the talent question, which is a great one. There's not 50 million engineers sitting in the UAE.
That was the purpose of my question.
Right? But India has way more engineers, way more development talent. That's their strength. The UAE's strength, like if I pick on Abu Dhabi specifically, Abu Dhabi's cash rich. So your focus should be play to your strengths. More venture funds, more investing, more ecosystem building that is driven by government investment initially, in the hopes that the pump becomes self-sustaining over time.
Mm.
But play to your strengths. Don't try and play someone else's game. We're never going to have as many engineers here as they have in India. Okay, so let's figure out where we're smart. We have resources. A lot of very smart and wealthy business people come here. Let's put management here. Let's put marketing here. Let's put publishing here. And let's use government resources, government dollars, to prime those pumps.
Yep.
Dubai is a great hub for events. People love to come to Dubai. Love to come vacation there. There should be the Olympics of gaming events, right? We should have PAX, TwitchCon, every major DreamHack. We should have every major gaming event happen over a 10-week period in Dubai, and it should just be the Olympics of gaming events. Play to your strengths. Dubai is not cash rich. It's not.
Yeah.
So investment maybe doesn't make sense. But subsidizing events, attracting event and hospitality talent.
Infrastructure is there.
The infrastructure is there. And so everyone has a part to play. Not everyone is going to have all the pieces, but collectively you end up with a regional ecosystem that I think is very compelling. Yeah. You're talking about places that are an hour away from each other. You're an hour flight from Dubai to Riyadh. You're an hour drive from Dubai to Abu Dhabi. Like this is not a big place.
Even there's a big pool of talent like 2 hours away from here.
Where?
I mean, in the region.
For sure. You have Lebanon has great talent. You have Armenia that has great talent.
Jordan, Egypt.
You're right.
Pakistan, India.
Absolutely.
These countries, they have like, they provide great talent. It's like 2 hours away from here. You can have your business hub here and then hire people from around you.
But you want the irony is this region has already done this very successfully in other industries.
Exactly.
Look at construction. Look at hospitality. Look at all these other industries, retail, that have leveraged the great talent in the region that are 2 hours away, like you said, but still built industry here.
Yeah, exactly. I'm interested to know why you came to the region. I mean, you've been telling me like you ran stuff with the government in Canada.
Yeah.
You ran one of the most famous accelerator programs. You've been in the Valley. You've been in New York. Why you consider the region in the first place?
So I used to host a podcast called The Business of Esports. That was the first podcast that I launched before I had my show on CNBC.
Oh, this is my next question. Yeah. Get into it.
And I often would talk about where, in fact, this is where the Prophet nickname came from. So I would talk about the future a lot, where the future of gaming was going, where the future of tech was going. And it turned into almost like a segment on the show, Paul's Prophecies. Like I was, and these things would come true. Which was cool because, you know.
Star Trek fan at the end of the day.
That's it, right? Like, as the cult leader, you start to drink even your own Kool-Aid. You go, wow, maybe I am a prophet. Maybe I do see the future, right? And it became prophetic and the prophet nickname just stuck over the years. As part of those prophecies, I'm an Arab, I'm Lebanese, you know, that's my background. I'm born in Canada, but I have that sort of the roots from here. As part of that, I saw what was happening in this region, even sitting in New York. I had my ear to the ground and I saw what was starting to happen here. And I saw the pieces that were being put in place. I saw government starting to think about this before anything was even announced, before press releases, before any national strategies, before any of this. And I started to put out content that was like, hey, you, Mr. Listener of my podcast, don't realize you're sleeping on the opportunity in the Middle East. Everyone was talking about Asia, China, Korea, even Japan to a lesser extent, as the future of gaming markets. And I never saw it that way. I like to be a bit of a contrarian. I like looking at what everyone thinks and disagreeing. And so the Asia thing never interested me. Yes, you have huge populations, but the average spend is very low. Like, I never liked the dynamics of those markets, highly regulated, and the regulatory environments are chaotic, right? One second, they're literally bipolar. One second, China will approve a bunch of games. The next second, they don't want anyone gaming and they're restricting it. So from a business standpoint, those markets scared me.
Yeah.
And I saw in the Middle East the exact opposite. Fast moving, governments with conviction, lots of money, business-friendly environments, right? Like, check, 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 check. And so I started with this sort of, at the time, was a contrarian viewpoint of, forget Asia, everyone's sleeping on the Middle East. And over time, I would say this on one episode, became saying it on 10 episodes, became saying it, I probably said it on 100 episodes. And at some point, I realized, I'm a little bit tired of talking about it.
Let's do it.
Let's just do it, right? Like, so this is taking longer than I thought. So I'm gonna uproot everything here and I'm gonna just go do it. And be a part of it and drink my own Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
With keeping with the cult analogy. And I think that was really the driving force behind it. Because at some point, if you believe in something strongly enough and you want people to see things your way, you have to be willing to go along with it yourself. It's not enough to just talk about it.
Lead.
Absolutely.
Lead or not. I mean, you mentioned The Business of Esports, your podcast.
Yeah.
And now this is like mostly a gaming podcast. And I've seen lots of attention and lots of mixing up in the region here, as well as other regions, by the way, between gaming and esports. While I personally see it as like not a similar or not, I mean, it's a correlated industry, but it's not the same industry. I still feel that there's focus on esports and gaming at the same time here. your podcast was Business of Esports, but you used to discuss mostly gaming stuff. So what do you have to say about that?
Look, in retrospect, I probably wish I had called it the Business of Gaming podcast.
Okay.
If I could do it all over, which is why my show on CNBC is Game Changers. It's not, right? Like,
Esports Changers.
It's much simpler branding. I think at the time, the thought, esports, first of all, was a much hotter buzzword. It was the product of its environment and its time and point in history.
Better for business tourism.
Better for listeners, attracting listeners, right? Like, you just looked at what was being searched. Esports was a much higher search topic than anything else. So part of it was that. I think also there was this idea that I wanted to convince the world that gaming and esports as terms were interchangeable. They meant the same thing. And part of it was driven by this idea that if you and I go play basketball, you know, on a public court or football, just in a field, just you and me, I could go home and say, I played a sport today. We didn't have an audience. We weren't professionals. We didn't get paid. There was no stage. All the things that today people adhere to this strict definition of esports, right? Professionals on a stage competing for money in front of an audience, right? Like, so to me, the word sport extended far beyond that tip of the iceberg, the top 1%. And so I figured, okay, if sports can do that, esports should have the same latitude, should have that same flexibility from a terminology standpoint. Mm. It should encompass everyone who plays. That was the idea. It's everyone who plays. That's what esports is. And I think I failed in that evangelism. You know, trying to convince the world that esports and gaming were the same didn't work. And today, esports is still the tip of the iceberg that people talk about in terms of competitive gaming, and gaming is broadly the industry of everything else, right?
Yeah.
Or at least esports is a subset of gaming. It's a small professional subset of gaming. And I think in some ways that's unfortunate. I'll tell you why, because I think to get the masses interested in the business of gaming, the word sport feels more approachable for most people who aren't maybe hardcore gamers themselves. The same way metaverse as a word made gaming feel comfortable for investors, because gaming feels, ooh, it's 12-year-olds in their basement.
Yeah.
I don't invest in 12-year-olds in their basement. But metaverse, well, that sounds professional. That sounds like the future, right?
Yeah.
I can get behind that. When in reality, metaverse and gaming, esports, it's all the same thing. And so I thought of it as a word that could make this more accessible to the masses because it played on something people already knew and understood. And this is, I think I failed there, because esports today has a very, very strict definition. It's a very, very minute, minuscule part of the gaming industry as a whole. It's really not even, it has no importance.
Yeah,
really.
This is my question. Why is there that much interest in esports in the first place?
It's misplaced understanding of where the value in the gaming market is.
Okay.
It's too many consultants who, this is what they see or hear about, so this is what they report back as being important. It's if you let someone from McKinsey decide what is important and that person has never played a game in their life, right? It's the result of that. The reality is esports has always been, since its inception, both financially unsustainable.
Exactly. Dane. I've read news about this. I haven't seen anyone. I mean, I've seen some athletes actually making money and some teams are making money, but usually sponsors and they don't make money from this.
This is a very deep topic.
Yeah.
Why? Because the big answer is, media rights don't exist in esports, A, and B, the games are still owned by the developers, right? Like, no one owns football, but someone owns Counter-Strike.
Yeah.
And can decide what you can and can't do with Counter-Strike.
Mm.
And so there's structural issues that I think prevent esports from being financially sustainable. The second piece that's problematic is it's still a highly niche product that is mostly used as a marketing exercise by the developers. In other words, I put on a big esports event because, not because I hope that esports event makes money. I'm happy if that breaks even. But what I want is people to buy the latest DLC for my game, or buy the battle pass that's attached to this esports event, or the compendium in the case of Dota, or whatever it is, right? Like, there's a lot of ways of using esports as a marketing tool, in which case it's an expense.
Yeah.
It's an expense line, not a revenue line. And then you can justify it. It's no different than buying Google ads.
Yeah, right.
So what I love about esports is, great marketing tool, has worked quite well. You know, you look at League of Legends, Riot has done an incredible job of using esports as a way to increase the audience of players of League.
Yep.
But as an endeavor, as a standalone endeavor, I think it's always been a mistake to pursue. Now, the asterisk there is, if you have unlimited funds and you don't know what to do with it, put on the biggest esports events you want, right? Like, at that point, the business playbook gets thrown out the window and you go,
yeah,
if money is no object, great. I think it's cool. And this is sort of where Saudi Arabia is. Yeah, I think the people of Saudi Arabia think having the esports World Cup there is something to be proud of. And it doesn't matter what it costs. And it doesn't matter how much money it loses. And that's fine. I applaud that, as long as we're all honest about it and we're not pretending like this is going to lead to some trillion-dollar esports industry that is financially sustainable. No. Saudi Arabia will need to continue to write hundreds of millions of dollars of checks every year to keep that Saudi esports ecosystem afloat.
Now that you've been talking about this, I think this is my opinion. There are two sides why the governments here, or I mean the region in general, is interested in esports. One is because it's one of the, we consume games the most. I mean, the average revenue per user is the highest here in the region.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Yeah, so we're consumers of games. That's why esports might make sense. So
yep.
Our youth might become athletes at some point. The other one is, I think, because the region missed on the traditional sports.
True.
So maybe esports would one day become something interesting, like that one day would become an industry where we could have the Real Madrid, the Barcelona, the Manchester United here in the region, but for the esports, you know?
Again, because of the structural differences, I'm not convinced. Yeah.
Definitely.
Right? You could get maybe pretty close to break even, but this is not going to be a major GDP contributor. And the reality is, like, esports are fundamentally a digital product. So even the tourism argument is not that strong. Yes, you may end up with an event eventually that's as big as, you know, League of Legends World Championships. And you may get 100,000 people that show up and fill a stadium to watch an event for 4 days. But beyond that, the majority of the viewers are going to be online, right? That's always the case in esports. There's always more people watching online than in the stadium. So the tourism argument is maybe weaker even with esports than it is with traditional sports. Weaker even than Taylor Swift. Like, you're better off investing in Taylor Swift concerts if you want to drive tourism.
Yes.
But what I like about esports is it's still the tip of the iceberg. It's the visible, sexy part that people see. So from a marketing standpoint, from a selling the vision standpoint, from a inspiring the people around standpoint, it's a good opportunity. Like, I don't poo-poo it completely. It's a good opportunity. It's the aspirational kind of it's the 9/11, right? It's the Porsche 911.
Yeah.
You sell a few Porsche 911s, you make no money on 911s, but because you sell the Porsche 911, a bunch of people buy Cayennes.
Yeah.
Where you make a lot more money. Right? So it's still that aspirational tip of the iceberg, which I think has a place if you're resource rich. So for places like Abu Dhabi, for places like Saudi Arabia, it makes sense. If I'm Morocco, going after esports to me makes no sense at all. This is not playing to your strengths.
Yeah. And okay, cool. And when you mentioned the metaverse maybe made it easier for investors to understand or to get into gaming in the first place, What's interesting for me is to understand, since you've been on the traditional startups VC side and now you're on the gaming VC side, is there a certain type of mind shift that you have to do in order to invest in gaming companies versus investing in traditional tech companies? Like, how does it work? Is there any difference in the first place?
There are some differences, but they're not, I think, as deep as people think. Like, one of the differences people will talk about investing in, and let's be clear, because there's investing in game studios, like people making games, and then there's investing in gaming technology, you know, tools. Gaming platforms, tools, like there's a lot of ancillary stuff that's still gaming, but is not game studios specifically. So if we're specific about game studios, investing in game development, right? This is still very binary, usually, in its outcome. It's still a very hit-driven business, yeah. Closer probably to investing in movies or theater shows than it is investing in more traditional tech. Because if I invest in a more traditional tech startup, right, even if the product doesn't sell, whatever was built, there's a good chance that the IP that was developed, the technology, the software, whatever, the hardware, whatever that what was built, there's some value potentially there to someone. There's a good chance my investment won't go to zero. I may just break even. I may be able to sell this to a bigger player, you know, for the value of the technology. But the reality is there's some inherent value there. With a game, if a game doesn't sell, if no one plays the game, the value is basically zero. It truly is quite binary. And so it's a small difference, and I don't put too much emphasis on it because I actually don't think the difference is that significant. But I think with anything that's hit driven, and I would put most of early stage venture in that, not just gaming, but anything that's hit driven, you need to have a really comprehensive portfolio strategy. The more hit driven the sector you're investing in, the more your portfolio diversification matters. And what I mean by that is, if all you do is invest in crypto games and crypto games on mobile, and that's all you do,
it's the most dynamic environment you can invest in.
But like, and I'm picking on Animoca here, but like, if that's all you do and you're wrong about crypto games ever being a thing and crypto games on mobile being a thing, you're going to be wrong in a spectacular way. Versus an investor where I think is smarter to say, okay, let me put some bets in mobile, let me put some bets in PC, so platform diversification, genre diversification, some shooters, some puzzles, some racings and whatever, right? So there's multiple ways. Stage diversification even is another way you can, right? So two guys in a garage with an idea for a game versus a game that's maybe ready to be published. You can play on both those ends and still be an early stage investor that's disciplined. So I think the more hit driven the nature of what you're investing in is, the more you need to be diversified to make sure, or try and make sure, you end up with that next Fortnite in your portfolio. Yeah. Scale also matters to a certain extent. If you only make 5 investments, the chance of hitting on the next Fortnite's low. If I make 500, well, my chance has gone up pretty significantly.
Exactly. We've seen some reluctance from VCs in the region when it comes to investing in gaming businesses. What do you have to say to these VCs if they are watching us about the gaming business, and how do you compare this to your previous experience in Canada when VCs started investing?
Yeah, I think you can't leave it. You can't be at the mercy of a VC who's maybe based in LA or in Miami or in London, right? To decide that they should come invest in a gaming startup in Abu Dhabi. Like I said, you need to prime the pump. That process, like that London VC showing up in Abu Dhabi and investing in a gaming company there, will never happen organically.
Yeah.
Or happen so rarely that it will have no significant impact on the ecosystem.
Or if they hear they're actually raising as well.
See, but this is where it's financial tourism again. It's career tourism. Are you here because you care about building the ecosystem here? Or are you here giving lip service in the hopes that
Yeah.
Mubadala puts $50 million in your fund.
Yeah.
Right? Do you genuinely care about the future of that ecosystem here? Because if the second Mubadala puts $50 million in your fund, you're on a plane back to London, I would argue you probably don't care that much.
Yes, true.
And so there's a bit of financial tourism even on the VC side, not just on the career side, individual side. But I think you need to have catalysts for investors to care. And the way you do that, for example, is it could be government directly, but it could be government through essentially government-controlled entities that say, okay, and this is, I've been a big advocate for this. If the government of Abu Dhabi, through some mechanism, writes a $500,000 check into a gaming startup here, whether it's a studio or technology, whatever, right?
Mm.
This is a powerful catalyst. Imagine the pitch to an investor sitting in Silicon Valley. Hey, there's a really cool gaming startup in Silicon Valley. Great team. By the way, we're going to put the first $500,000 or $1 million. Our money is maybe less dilutive. It comes with some subsidies. It comes with some ecosystem benefits. And by the way, because we care about the ecosystem, we'll be the last money out. Do you want to invest alongside? Do you want to come spend some time here? We've now de-risked this investment massively for you. Well, now this is interesting, because for that guy sitting in Silicon Valley, this is an opportunity to juice his returns. He looks good in front of his investors, and he doesn't have to care anymore. When the caring becomes less of a requirement because we've done that for him.
Yeah.
We're worrying about the caring part. We're worrying about the commitment part. We're managing the marriage, right?
Yeah.
But that becomes a powerful catalyst for foreign direct investment, which is what you need to put an ecosystem on the map. And Canada, again, great analogy. If Canada had only had Canadian funds investing in Canadian companies.
Yeah, I was surprised when you told me you had foreign investment coming to Canada.
Because a lot of it was, hey, I'm sitting in Canada. I'll put the first check. I'll be the last money out. The company here is getting 50% of their operational costs covered through these credits and these subsidies. You, Mr. Investor, sitting in Silicon Valley, this is a great opportunity for you. Your investment is massively de-risked. The risk calculation changes dramatically. And VCs are not stupid. They're conscious of it.
Yeah, yeah.
They look at both sides, the return side and the risk side. And so where government has to play is, I always think about, how are you a catalyst and what are you a catalyst for? For example, no one's doing this. Actually, maybe I shouldn't even say on this podcast, but there's a way that governments could be subsidizing gaming companies that almost no one globally is doing. There's maybe one place in the world that's doing this well, that's not OPEX or CAPEX, that would drive direct GDP growth, attract more foreign direct investment.
UA money? User acquisition money? Media money?
Yep. This is an interesting one, yeah.
Definitely. Yep.
This is one of those things that, and it's again, this is where my evangelism, I think, is important, is these are ideas that have to happen for the region to be successful long term. We have to be thinking a bit differently. We have to be creative about the solutions we bring to market. We have to apply those resources efficiently. And that's the challenge, right? Getting the players aligned with that vision.
Yeah, this is from the policymaker's perspective. If we're talking to the VC person that is now like watching and then they stumble upon this episode, what would you tell them as a VC person about like investing in gaming in the region?
My advice would be, don't be financial tourists, right? If you're gonna spend any time here, have a real reason why.
There are existing VCs.
Oh, I mean, if you're talking about the ones that are here.
Yeah,
already,
exactly.
There are, but they're relatively few and they're relatively small, right? You get like this barbell effect here. You have a few that are very small that aren't really, that are what we call subscale, right? They're not as big as the VCs in the West. And so they have their own challenges. And then you have the opposite end, like the Mubadalas of the world,
yeah,
where the smallest check they want to write is $50 million. Yeah. And so, like, there's a big gap in between that still needs to be filled. Now, my advice for that section that would invest here, is based here, has boots, yeah, on the ground here, is you still can't go it alone. Like, if you don't have deep gaming expertise in house, it doesn't matter what, like, you can't go and expect to make money investing in gaming if you don't have deep expertise. And I mean deep expertise with global networks where you can bring value immediately, right? Like the day that VC writes a check,
yeah,
he can make two phone calls or she can make two phone calls and I've grown the value of that portfolio company. That's still lacking here somewhat. There's not a lot of that yet. And that exists much more. It's much more prevalent in Europe, in the West, in North America, where the VCs have deeper networks, have longer time doing this, have more experience doing this, and can bring more value to those portfolio companies. So I think it's focus on where you can add value, but also figure out why you're investing in gaming and why you want to play in that space here. Have a thesis behind it.
Mm.
I think not enough do it with a deep thesis in mind beyond gaming's cool, gaming's hyped, you know, we should play there. That's interesting, but, you know, I always think you have to work backwards from something. You have to have an end goal that you're convinced of. My holodeck thesis, I think that end goal is inevitable. There's nothing, an asteroid could hit the planet. I still think we will end up at holodecks.
Yeah. Cool. I expect like people from abroad, mostly publishers, game developers, even VCs, would watch this episode. What would you, where would you position us as a region? Because they are interested. They are seeing news around the region. Well, where would you say we are in the, if we set the goal as becoming a gaming hub?
Yep.
And we reverse back. Where do you think we are today? Where would you position us? And how long do we still need to become a gaming hub for these guys to understand when and where to intervene?
I mean, it's a great question. Timelines are always tough to predict, even for the prophet. In the sense that we can control a lot of factors, but because you can't control everything, timelines often rely on some amount of luck, some amount of, you know, the right person in the right place at the right time, making the right decision,
yeah,
to drive things forward, right? And so I while I'm convinced of that end goal, there will be a global gaming hub here. The timeline, I could probably argue for 5 years, and I could argue for 20 years, and I could argue for probably every timeline in between. Like there's factors outside of all of our control that will determine how fast we get there.
Yep.
I think for people on the outside, you have to spend time here, right? Like you have to embed yourself here, or at least have a person embedded in the ecosystem here to understand the nuance both of doing business here, the nuance of what it is to build a gaming company here, the nuance of all the players and government and private sector here. Like it's not the kind of thing you show up for a day or two, learn and have mastered and go back and figure out how to invest here intelligently. So
yeah,
you need boots on the ground. You need a permanent presence. Otherwise, you're just a tourist again. I think what I would, the way I would inspire those people, though, is you have all the elements here of major success. You have a geographic location that is perfectly between East and West. So from a gaming reach standpoint, from a where are my customers standpoint, how do I serve those customers very efficiently? You have maybe the one of the most perfect locations on the planet. That's the first thing. You have young populations, both in the Middle East and in Africa, which is a market that is accessible, yeah, from here. You have governments, whether they do it perfectly or not, and we spent a lot of time on that, that still have way more conviction and more skin in the game than governments in the West.
Definitely.
You have opportunity that, like, there's no dominant AAA studios that have come out of here yet. There's no huge publishers that gatekeep every game that comes out of here, right? Like there's still white space. There's no dominant content platform. There's no, right? Like there's nothing that has been won yet. So from a where are we on the hockey stick, we're still, I think, very early. And to me, as if I'm trying to evangelize this to outsiders, that's exciting. Why would you go to a place where you're already three quarters of the way up the hockey stick if you can come to a place where you haven't even hit that inflection point yet?
I love this. Cool. So guys, you know, Paul is giving you the perfect advice. I'm interested to know, what's, as a VC, I've always wondered as a VC, what's something that you regret doing or not doing? Maybe an investment you passed on.
Oh my God, that's a touchy. You don't. That's, first of all, you never ask a VC that question because they all have some horrible story that haunts them.
It fuels us as studios, you know.
I mean, I tell this story very openly. I was managing Garage at the time, and I was spending a lot of time in Silicon Valley at the time. You know, I was single, and so I was dating this, or at least I was out for dinner that night with this very beautiful woman. And I, you know, I sort of knew how I wanted that evening to go. And we finished dinner, and a friend of hers walks into the restaurant as we're finishing dinner, and she invites him to sit at our table. I'm going, oh God, you know, this is third wheel. This is definitely not the ideal scenario. Let's put it that way. And worst of all, she tells him I'm a VC, and he starts pitching me his company. And I'm checked out. Like at that point, I've definitely completely checked out. I'm not paying attention. I tell him to keep his day job. This is a dumb idea, you know. And to his credit, by the way, never threw me under the bus. Although some of those guys have talked about how the first like half dozen VCs that they pitched told them this idea was worthless. But I famously passed on this company, which the guy who walked into the restaurant was a guy named Joe Gebbia, who was one of the three co-founders of a company at the time, which was called AirBedAndBreakfast.com, not even Airbnb.com. And I kept that business card as a reminder of my own stupidity, as a reminder that, you know, you're not going to be right all the time. Even the profit's not right 100% of the time, as difficult as that is to admit. And so I famously passed on that seed round, could lose a lot of sleep over the billions that cost me, but I think any investor who does this long enough, any VC who does this long enough has passed on some great opportunities because the reality is, and this is maybe something founders don't appreciate, VCs are humans and you see 1,000 pitches in a year and on any given day, there's the context of that day, right? Maybe that morning that VC had a fight with his wife. And so the pitches he sees that day, he's not thinking about, right? He's more worried about his situation at home, how he's going to make it up to his wife, whatever, right? He's grumpy. He's not in a good mood. And so...
Or on a date.
Thank you. But it's this case where it's not an exact science, right? And while you may think you have the greatest idea in the world, the greatest company in the world, the greatest game in the world, whatever it is, raising money is a volume game because of the human element involved. You have to talk to 100 VCs. You need to evangelize and sell to as many people as will listen in the hopes that you catch the right person on the right day with the right approach, with the right pitch, right? There's a lot that has to go right to get dollars in the bank. And that's part of what makes that process interesting, I think, right? It's a fascinating kind of process that I think a lot of founders hate. And, you know, even me to this day hates the idea of raising money, right? Like it's probably one of the worst parts of any job, whether you're a VC raising your next fund or a founder raising capital for your business. It's never fun asking other people for money.
Yeah, never easy.
But if you approach it very pragmatically and with this understanding that there is still human fallibility in this, right? Like that the humans will still make bad decisions and that shouldn't deter you from your own vision and your own convictions, that I think you can handle it a lot easier.
You reminded me of something you always tell me, that 80% of what you do will most probably fail.
Yes.
So yeah, I like that.
Fortunately, people only remember the 20% that succeeds, though. That's the greatest part about entrepreneurship, in fact, that the big successes in your career is basically all people will remember.
Yep. This leads me into asking you, if someone were to start today and knowing what you know today versus what you knew at the time when you started, what is one piece of advice that you think is the most important to give that person, be it an entrepreneur or a VC or anyone trying to do something new today?
Yeah, I think you have to approach whatever you're doing with an intensity. I hate using the word passion because it's not passion. I don't believe that you need to love what you do, but you need to care about being good at what you do. So if it's being a founder, you need to be good at selling, or you need to partner with someone who's good at selling, because you're going to spend your life selling your startup, selling yourself, selling your products, right? Like, you need to possess to be good at the skills required to do the job you've chosen to do, and do it with an intensity that is at a high enough level to reach success. So I think that's the first thing. It's an intensity and a willingness to do the things you're good at, or an approach to do the things you're good at. The second part, I think, is really long-term persistence. It comes back to what you said before. Failure is part of this game. You will fail way, 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 way more than you succeed. Again, even as a VC, right?
Yeah.
Every VC portfolio, half the portfolio pretty much goes to zero. That's how almost every VC portfolio is modeled. So failure is built into this career choice, whether you're a founder or VC. And how you deal with that, the persistence you bring to that, do you keep getting up in the morning with excitement around the convictions you had, excitement around your vision, despite whatever setbacks happened that day? And for most founders, it's a miserable living. It really is. Most days are miserable.
Yeah.
And if you look at the statistics, we did a study a long time ago, like 20 years ago, when I started at Garage. The average startup from beginning to exit in Canada at that time took 6 years to get from beginning to exit.
Okay.
From, you know, the day you found it to some kind of event. Either it's a good exit
or failure or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Right? And on average, the average entrepreneur, it took three at-bats, three goes at it, before they had a successful exit.
Mm.
And so when you put the math together, you realize being an entrepreneur is literally almost a 20-year, I'm rounding up here, almost a 20-year promise. It's a 20-year commitment if you want to be successful from day one, that you have to be at it for at least 20 years if you want to just be average, right?
You have to be crazy.
But keep in mind, averages have distributions on both sides. Yeah. So for some people, that's going to be 25 years. For some, it may be 15. Mm. For some, it may be 35. It will literally have a bell curve around the average. It's a normal distribution. And so,
I'm sure you're discouraging many people now.
But that's good. I hope I do.
Grounding them.
No, I hope I discourage 99 out of 100 from ever doing it. But the one person who listens to me and goes, oh, I'm built for this.
Yeah.
That person, come talk to me. That's the person I want to back, right? That's the person who I know will be successful. I'd rather root out the ones who, again, we come back to this tourism thing, is entrepreneurial tourism.
Yeah.
We're coining a lot of terms here.
Yeah, I like that.
Right? It's entrepreneurship tourism. It's like, it's sexy. You know, I watched a Gary Vee video. Like, this is cool. I can do it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That was a direct shot at Gary, by the way. Making entrepreneurship cool was probably the biggest mistake we've made as an industry in the last 25 years. Mm-hmm. It should never have been cool. It's hard. It's exceptionally
definitely.
Hard.
Definitely.
And it's not just gaming. It's every kind of entrepreneurship.
You mentioned that the 1% come to me. What are you working on today? Like, what's your focus as Paul?
Still the media and evangelism, no question. That's still a big part of what I care about and where I spend a lot of my time, making sure the right ideas are in the right hands of the right people, and that I'm the cult leader that can rally everyone around a vision. That's short-term goal. That's where my head is at.
Mm.
Can I get everyone to see my view of the world and get on board with it and want to join that fight? That's the thing I'm most passionate about today, the thing I spend maybe a lot of my energy on. Where I spend some of the day-to-day work is still mandates with governments, free zones, ministries, who are all trying to navigate their own way through the gaming landscape and figure out what they should be doing. Should we be investing? Should we be doing events? Should we be doing esports? Should we, right? Like,
yeah.
Where should we allocate the capital? How do we attract companies? How do we create jobs? How do we create GDP growth? Right? So thinking through all of those things, whether it's in Saudi or Dubai or Abu Dhabi or in Ras Al Khaimah or in Bahrain or you name it, right? I've touched in every single one of these places and continue to spend time in all of these places with governments and ministries and free zones and all of these places. So that's day-to-day takes a lot of my time. I think where the, you know, for me, there's always been this investment component that I've never shied away from, which is, you know, when I see interesting opportunities that I get excited about, no question, I want to be a part of that in some way. Sometimes that's as an investor, sometimes that's as an advisor, sometimes it's, you know, helping in just making introductions. Like for me, staying close to that startup ecosystem in one way or another will always be important to me, will always be part of my day to day. So
are you actively investing these days?
Yeah, selectively, right? Like my bar is high,
yeah,
very high. Like I won't touch anything today that's Web3 gaming, that's crypto gaming. Not because I think it has no chance of success, I just think no one has really figured it out yet. It hasn't figured out its reason to exist yet.
Mm.
And when I see that, and I hope people take that as constructive criticism, right? But it's a challenge to figure it out. That I have optimism,
yeah.
But I, as an investor, I'm not going to put capital in something that I think hasn't been figured out yet. Game development is still tricky in this region, right? It's still underfunded. So as an individual investor, you don't want to be the only money backing something if there you don't know where the next check's going to come from.
Yeah.
So there's trickiness there. Gaming technology, infrastructure, the picks and shovels, that stuff is a little bit easier. It's easier to fund. It's easier to see sort of an endpoint. The buyers are usually easier to find. The value is usually easier to get your head around. That's where probably I've spent more time and more effort these days.
Mm-hmm.
But look, I'm very bullish on usually places where no one's looking. And ironically today, very few people are looking at traditional game development.
Yeah.
Right? The Web3 game development gets all the hype, is getting all the dollars. The picks and shovels, the tools, there's plenty of people looking at that. The lost middle child today is real, like very traditional, we're making a game, whether it's a console game or mobile game or PC game, right?
Yeah.
And we're just going to make a normal game that people will pay for and have fun playing. Like,
yeah.
It sounds crazy, but I actually think there's a huge opportunity that very few people are chasing right now.
Yeah, but I think people are now focusing more on tools and these things.
It's easier to
because of traditional gaming, because it's underfunded.
True.
You know? Like people went like escaped the traditional gaming. Now it became interesting again for someone like you. Anyway, for people that are interested to follow your work and maybe reach out if they have like some interesting ideas, where's the best place to follow your work?
I would love for people to watch Game Changers on CNBC Arabia. I think that's a fantastic show which gives you insight into the gaming industry on a weekly basis. So we're covering news. You've been a guest on my show. We bring great people on the show, C-suite, you know, people who have deep insight on the industry, especially in the region. It's very focused on the region. So if you're looking for that entry point, where do I get high-level information in maybe 15 or 20 minutes every week? It gives me a window into the region. I think Game Changers is probably the best to do that today. If people want to follow me personally on LinkedIn, I'm easy to find. I'm Paul the Prophet. Dawalibi, it's easy. You just put in Paul the Prophet. I'm the only one.
Yeah.
You know, I have a relatively large following on places like Instagram and X and things like that. So it's almost always Paul_the Prophet if people want to follow me there.
Cool. Paul, it was really nice having you. I really enjoyed the conversation. And yeah, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. And I just want to say, I think the industry needs more of podcasts like this, needs more of content like this, people like you asking great questions like this. And I just wish you continued success with it.
Thanks a lot. Cheers.
Thank you. Thank you.